Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Neil from the Rebellion Dogs group in Harrisburg. Yeah.
Can you all hear me? My name is Neil D., alcoholic. I had to pause there for a minute because normally I say my entire name, but I think this is being recorded and it's going to be on the internet, so I didn't want to throw out my whole name. I don't know if you all, I always say I'm a recovered alcoholic because I know what my illness is, and I know the process to recover from that. The funny thing is I was at home and I opened up this little box I had, and I found this schedule for my very first AA meeting, and on it was the date was 1996. There was five names on that schedule that, you know, on the back they wrote their names in. Out of the five of those people, one of them has passed away. He died sober. He was actually my second sponsor. The other one, he had relapsed. He was my first sponsor. And the other three are still alive and still sober. So I thought that was a really amazing thing because, in a way, those folks and I, all those people had been involved in service at one point in time or another. And I really think that has a lot to do with the staying involved in this process. But 96 was obviously not the beginning of the story. So I will start. I'm not going to talk a lot about my drinking. There's a couple key pieces, though, because the condition that I have suffered from is the condition of alcoholism. And I came into AA not knowing what alcoholism was. I thought alcoholism was that I drank too much and I had problems. But I came to find out by being in AA that's not my full condition. I come from a long line of alcoholics. None of them have really distinguished themselves in any type of way other than that they drank and they had problems and they continued to drink. My grandfather, he died at 72. My great-grandfather died. He was drunk at the racetrack and had fallen down the steps. And that's just on my grandfather's side. My dad is still alive. He is actually in recovery. He has about 6 years, which is amazing for him, because he's not doing it through AA. He came to some meetings. He was like, "That's not for me," but he stayed sober. Just so you know, I have a dry date. It is March 30th of 1998, and I have not needed to pick up a drink. But that's not to say during that time, throughout the years, that I haven't thought about drinking. Because when I was new, I'd hear people talk about being sober for a while and not thinking about drinking, and it really screwed me up. And this is about me carrying my message of Alcoholics Anonymous, my experience and my strength and my hope. I was really confused when I first got here about a whole lot of things. I thought everybody that came to AA was all sober for a very long time. I thought I was the only one that couldn't get it. And because, you know, I was selfish and self-centered, wrapped up in self, all that. Oh, another thing I just want to mention. So I don't know if it was a month ago, my wife was here. And she spoke and she referred to me as house arrest guy. So I just want to put that out there because, you know, it's on the website, and I listened to it. I was like, "House arrest guy? Really? Like, you could have said my actual name like that." So my parents got divorced when I was really young, I'm going to mention this is not why I'm an alcoholic. My parents got divorced when I was really young. My mom went to England, where she still lives today, and my dad stayed here in America. My dad, being a person that drank, a self-proclaimed alcoholic, he traveled a lot, little air quotes, traveled a lot He was a truck driver, so that afforded him the ability to drive up and down the East Coast. And at the time, I don't know if we have any truck drivers in the room, but back in the day, they actually had logbooks that they had. I think there's still some today. They had logbooks that they would fill out, and he would lie on his logbook, and he would drive like 17, 20 hours straight. And then once he got to his destination, he could drink for several days and I guess work it out mathematically in the book to indicate that he was safely driving from one place to another. It really sounded like a really good racket when I look back on it, I'm thinking, man, I should have been a over-the-road truck driver. Like that sounded like really good. But I was unable to because of the DUIs I got. So anyways, the state of Pennsylvania frowns on that. It's odd. I grew up basically with my grandparents. They raised me. God loved them. They did a fantastic job. I think back on it like they were in their 50s. Here comes this little kid, 5-6 years old. I would not want to. I'm 46 now. I would not want to raise my grandchildren. So any of you that are raising your grandchildren, God love you. God bless you. I had this great opportunity to be raised out on this 18-acre farm. My grandparents didn't do any farming, but it was a great place for me to be alone, all by myself, in this head. Now, I don't know how you guys are as alcoholics, but the last place I should ever be is alone in this head. But I didn't know that at the time, so it was great. So I went to school. I didn't do well in school. They determined that I had some learning disabilities, so they put me in a special class. And, you know, all jokes aside, I was a short bus rider. I didn't know how that was going to affect me. So if we have any short bus riders out there tonight, it's okay. Welcome. I can relate. I see. So I love the nodding and the laughter because there's two things that happen. When people nod, that means they're like, yep. And when they laugh, it's the laughter of identification. So that really helps me out. When I say some really crazy or sick stuff and you guys are laughing, I know exactly what kind of crowd I have. So there was a couple laughs of the really sick people. So as I grew up, I'm going to classes, I'm not doing well. I started playing football. I did pretty well in that because all I had to do is be, you know, kind of big and run and block people and run into them, which really came natural to me. I learned violence in the fourth grade. So I would get picked on because I was a short bus rider, and the other kids would make fun of us. And my best friend at the time, Todd, he taught me that if you just go up and punch him in the face, they stopped making fun of you. And I was like, what a concept. And so violence is an answer. It's not the answer, but it definitely is a answer. And it's not one that I use today, thank God. So then playing football, I did fairly well. I actually got some interest from a college. They were going to give me some partial money to play football for them. But my lifelong goal was to be in the military. So right out of high school, I went into the service. Now, I want to throw in this really quick. My very first drink, I was 9 years old. I remember the age. I remember the location I was. I remember who I was with. I remember what it was. I remember where I got it. I remember all of it, like it happened yesterday. And so my grandparents there was a bottle of Jack Daniels underneath the sink, you know, where you keep your poisons, and the shot glasses were on the very top shelf. So I remember going and getting that fifth of Jack Daniels and grabbing two shot glasses and going out to the living room, and Todd and I were sitting watching TV. I was left unsupervised a lot. That's dangerous. And I poured two shots, one for me and one for Todd, and I took that first drink. And I did not go into a blackout or get drunk or any of that that night. It was the following weekend, and I drank vodka, Absolute vodka, and Orange Crush. because I didn't like orange juice. And they had orange juice, so I thought I had to have Orange Crush. I got absolutely fallen down drunk that weekend, and it was, up until that, it was the best experience in my 9 years that I had ever had, right? And that's when I knew I wanted to keep drinking. And I wanted to drink every opportunity I had. I wanted to drink, and that's all I wanted to do. There was some other substances used during those years, but it was always about, I always wanted to drink. It was just easier. It was hard to hit a fifth of Jack Daniels in my jean jacket coat pocket inside. I could easily put some baggies of anything in the jean jacket and nobody ever knew. So went into the Army right out of high school. That was going to save me because up until then, I was never much of a happy kid unless I was drunk. I was experiencing that restless, irritable, and discontent most of my life. And the only time I had found relief is when I had a few drinks. And as it says in the book, a few drinks that we see others take with impunity. There's nothing happens to them. Oddly enough, it's hard to maintain a drinking, I don't want to say habit, but lifestyle when you're 9, 10 years old. I did a lot of stealing from my grandparents. Money as well as alcohol that they had in the house. I would con people into getting me the things that I wanted, that I needed, even at a young age. I got through school because people would cheat for me. And so I'm manipulating, I'm lying, I'm doing all the things that I was going to work on and try to perfect later on. Went in the Army, that was really going to save my life. The only thing I ever wanted to be in my life was an airborne ranger. That was it. That was all I could ever see as my future. I was going to live and die in the Army. And so 2 years into my 2 years into my time in the military, they decided they no longer wanted me to be in their service. I had some issues with some substances that they frown upon. The other thing with that is they don't like it when you show up to formation drunk. They like it even less when you don't show up for formation drunk. And that had happened on too many occasions. Whenever I was in the field, away from barracks, I always did really well. I was a great soldier. And as soon as I would get back to the rear, wherever that was, I would find alcohol. Even when I didn't want to, I would end up finding it. I remember some buddies of mine were like, let's go downtown. And I'm like, no, that's a terrible idea. I can't go downtown. And they're like, come on, we won't stay long. And I'm like, okay. But even early on, so I was about 19, right around 20, and when I had this experience. When I was in the Army, so they have a thing called patent days in Luxembourg. So if you're not familiar with World War II, Patton tore through Luxembourg on his way someplace else and liberated the country's very small. And so he liberated it by accident, but they were like so happy. So they invite American soldiers to march in their parade. They call it patent days. So what happened is they took us down to their country. They put us on a military base. It's on a mountain. It's a really tall mountain. And they had us dress up, put all our little shiny things on and our little everything. We go down. They take us to this beer festival that they're having. So they tell us, you're all allowed to have 2 beers. We're going to come down, you're going to shake hands, you're going to smile at the people, and then you're going to get back on the bus, and then we're going to take you back. So I went and had my 2 beers, and me and my buddy got back up to the base, said, I'm not done yet, come on, let's go. We climbed down over the fence, down the mountain, back to the beer fest. We couldn't stay there because there was officers there, and we just roamed around the town. I cannot remember any of the middle part of that. I don't know how many hours it was, what went on. The next thing what I remember is about halfway up the mountain, The sun was starting to come up, and it was raining out. And I'm thinking, what? This is not cool. Normal people don't do that once they start drinking. But that didn't last long. Got snuck back on base and, you know, wiped my hands of it. Didn't think any more of it. So they ended up kicking me out. I was at a low point at that stage because all I'd ever wanted to do was be in the military. That's it. And I had no idea what I was going to do. So I got out and, you know, it was a rough couple months because I was really indecisive. And so the only thing that would help me would be to drink. And so I would drink, and of course I would drink and I wouldn't achieve anything. And so I just drink some more. Had several different jobs, sales jobs, security jobs, always just enough to build up hope in myself and for the people that cared about me. I got married to a woman that had two kids from a previous marriage. We were together for about 3 years before we both just called it quits. And what we had was the relationship that we had would be that I would drink and ignore everyone. And I would just put my paycheck on the table and go about my business. And she would start fights with me to get me to interact with her because I was ignoring her. And I didn't see that at the time. That didn't come until I had gone and made an amends later on to my ex-wife and learned a whole lot about myself. So we split up. I used that as a good reason to continue drinking. So I was... Back before, when I was, you know, during that time, police would pull me over, and some of you probably remember this, police would pull you over, but they wouldn't give you a DUI. They would, like, look at you. Sometimes they'd give me a ride home. A couple times, I had a couple of them follow me home just to make sure I made it home safe. And so I had a whole lot of those. That never kept me from drinking and driving. I don't know what it was. I would drink and I would have to drive. Even if I was at home, I would drink and I would have to go someplace. I don't know. There we go. And I was a pretty good drunk driver. I didn't get in much trouble. I only got pulled over a few times. And, so the way part of my problems with my driving is how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The mechanic that my grandmother used, what I didn't know at the time, he had been sober and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 12 years. So he was watching this damage occur to the car over the years, right? And it's kind of, think about it, it's a certain like footprint that alcoholics leave on a car. It's the bumper, the guide rails, right? The bumper rails that are along the doorway. The missing side mirrors, they come off sometimes. There might be blood on the car that we're not really sure how that got there. Hopefully it's probably a beer. And so there's all these different things, telltale signs of an alcoholic. And don't get me wrong, those things can't happen to the normal driver occasionally. But when it's happening like week after week, month after month, year after year, I start to build up a pattern. So he suggested to my grandmother that I go to AA, to Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up at my first meeting. I mentioned the schedule, and I remember walking in there, and I remember these guys, not like this meeting. This meeting is fantastic. You guys are beautiful people. This meeting, it was down in a basement, it was dark, it was dingy. Of course, this is my alcoholic recall, right? Anything I dislike is horrible, right? It's the worst thing that could ever happen. And like, out drinking alcohol, best thing that ever happened. So I had this perception issue, right? I also have this alcoholic hearing that I only hear parts of things part of the time, and if it usually has something to do with me. There's maybe a little selfishness and self-centeredness. I don't know if you guys can relate to that. So I I walked down in this basement. First off, Joe, the guy, he's on this little card. He's outside and he's talking about baseball. And that's all he wants to talk about. He's the guy outside of the meeting. He's got the cowboy hat that matches his shirt, that matches his socks. Put together, right? He's like talking to me about baseball, and I'm like, I don't want to do talk. My life is falling apart. You don't understand. I lost my job. I got divorced from my wife. Like, I'm living in my grandmother's basement. It was a nice basement. I just picture that one light bulb hanging, just swinging, and it's got the little string. No, it wasn't like that at all. So my life is falling apart. And he's talking about baseball. I'm like, these people are horrible. And I walk down the basement, and it's dark, and there's a guy, he's sitting, they got it's in like a circle. And the guy's sitting, and this one guy's just sitting, like, got his arms crossed, and just looks miserable. Looks just like he could just use a drink, and I'm ready to go with him. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just waiting for somebody to say let's go, and I'm gonna leave. So I sit down, and they pass the basket, and I'm like, that's what it is. These people are after my money. Now, I mentioned that I lost my job. I didn't have any money in my account. So even if they were after it, there wasn't anything to get. But, you know, here they are. They're after my money. And then they talked about God. Whoa. You people were just too much. After the meeting, like many of us do, after a meeting, somebody says that they're new. We go up to them and we're like, hey, how's it going? Glad you're here. Welcome. We'll stick our hand out. We'll shake hands. We'll hand them the schedule with their names on it. And I'm quite certain that they were all very polite, with a spirit of love and service and just wanting to help. But that's not how I perceived it. How I perceived it was the zombie apocalypse had just occurred. I was the last human being on earth. And these people are the zombies. And they're like, keep coming back. And I'm like, no. So I went home after that meeting, and my grandmother was like, you know, with the anticipation, so what was it like? I said, oh, it was great. They said, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, nobody in that room said anything about me not being an alcoholic. And so I told her that, and she was like, oh. So that gave me a little bit more leeway, right, with my grandmother, who I'd been manipulating for a very long time, and basically taking everything that she gave me, plus some of the stuff that she didn't know I was taking from her. And I continued to drink. I moved out for a while, and then back. That was the pattern of behavior for me, to be out for a little while. I would find a roommate, or as we like to call them sometimes in AA, a hostage, right? So I would be at the bar, and I would meet Miss Right Now, and I would, you know, have a great line, and I would convince her, just like I've convinced so many other people in my life, that I was moving up. And, yeah, right? And I was quite a bit lighter back then, and I didn't have any gray hair. My hair was a little thicker. So I would always find some place to live for periods of time. It was never very difficult for me to do that. I noticed, and I mentioned periods of time, because sane women will only put up with our stuff for so long. And so fortunately, I would find some that were similar to me that would let me stay longer. But even with that, that was still, it would end up being cut off, like there was expectations, like something about it wasn't okay to bring another girl back to her house. I don't understand. And something about not showing up for 3 days, like that would occur. And to me, there's just being, you know, you're overreacting. People love it when you say that, you know, when they're upset about something. If you just throw in that you're overreacting, really calms everybody down. So I would end up, you know, with all my worldly possessions in the two garbage bags that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with. I like to think that I was light on my feet and able to move about quickly when needed. So there was somebody back there. Traveled around quite a bit. So I'm back in my grandmother's house again in 98. I had some issues this time. So there was other substances, like I mentioned. I'm just briefly going to mention cocaine. It goes with alcohol like peas and carrots. I would have issues with that substance. And I never wanted that until I started drinking. Once I started drinking, I had to have it. And it wasn't hard to find either. As long as I always had money and people were always willing to share it with me. And because if they weren't willing to share it with me, I would threaten them with violence, because violence still worked for me. And so that would work for a while. I experienced what I later found out was central nervous system shutdown. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what was going on. All I know is I came to, and it was very hard for me to breathe. It, almost impossible for me to breathe. It was just like... And I just relaxed because I knew the end was coming. Finally, I was going to die. And, you know, I had put myself in many positions for that to happen repeatedly, because I did not have a fear of death. What I had was a fear of living. I was afraid to keep living the way I was living. I was afraid of feeling the way I was feeling. And I'm 26 years old, and the only thing I really want out of life is for it to end. And so I come to in that condition, and I'm just like, take me. Fortunate for me, because I was able to calm myself down, eventually my breathing started back again normally. So what happens is that my throat just relaxed. The muscles just relaxed. And then it cuts off oxygen. And then generally what happens is you will try to force air in, which will close it up that much more. And since I relaxed, that didn't occur, obviously, because I'm still here. So it took about 45 minutes. I went upstairs. You know, I was a smoker, so I immediately smoked a cigarette because I just experienced something, right? I couldn't breathe. I need to smoke. So I'm on my grandmother's back porch, and my hands are just shaking. And like, I'm a mess, and I'm like, God, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I didn't drink at all for that whole week. But then I started feeling better. I just had a near-death experience, and I'm like, whew, can't do that anymore. But Friday, I'm back at the bar. And I'm only going to go in for two. Told myself, I'm only going in for two. I drank those two beers, and the next thing I know, it's 2:30 in the morning, they're calling last call. I was driving as fast as I could, doing 95 and a 35, because I was really hungry, and I was on my way to the 24-hour diner. And that's what I said to the cop when he pulled me over. Why are you going so fast? I'm really hungry. I will buy breakfast if you come with me. That didn't work. Didn't work at all. He charged me with another DUI, and I had gotten out of them like I had gotten out of them before. This was not the first time. I had the charges dropped before. I had them minimized. ARD, like I did all those things, and this time I was just like, no, I'm gonna get a DUI and go to jail, and this is how it's gonna be. I managed to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm in my grandmother's basement again with nothing going on in my life. I made this commitment that I just can't drink anymore. I'm just not gonna drink. I can't do it. And 2 weeks go by. I'm losing my mind. I call the AA hotline in Lancaster, and this I love this story. Joe H. He is he's still in Lancaster. He still does a lot of service work. He answered the phone when I called. And I was like, yeah, can you send me an AA schedule? Now, I had asked for them to mail me schedules before as part of my turning things around and to make my grandmother feel better. And, you know, she'd get that thing in the mail, and I'd be like, look what I have. And so this time I was like, yeah, can you mail me a schedule? And he said, you know, maybe you could just go down the street. There's a noon meeting in about an hour right down the block from your house. You could just go right down there and get a schedule right there. It would save me a lot of time, and it would save me postage. And I thought, these alcoholics can't even afford postage. Of course I'm going to help them out. I went down to that meeting. I got the schedule. I sat through it. I don't remember much of what was said during that meeting, but there was a guy. He was sitting over across the, and it was the same guy I had seen before. He looked just as miserable. This was several years later. And he looked at me, and what was different was me, I think. He looked at me and he said, whatever you're going through right now, you never have to feel this way ever again. You never have to feel this way ever again. And that floored me. Plus, there was this really cute girl sitting about two seats down. And I thought maybe if I came back, I could talk to her and we could hang out. She never came back to that meeting again. That had nothing to do with me. But I kept coming to that meeting. And that became my home group. I got involved in that home group. That guy that said, you never have to feel this way ever again, became my sponsor. We started working through the steps, and my life started to change. About 3 months sober, I went to my first YPAW conference, Young People in AA conference. It was Pensipaw 10 down in Lancaster. And I walked into this hotel with all these young people, and it changed my life. It gave me this experience that I'm so grateful that I had, because up until then, it was me and these six old dudes in this room and two old women that would come in. And so when I'm saying these old people, right, I was 26 at the time, and they were in their 40s, late 40s, right, maybe some 50s and 60s there. So I'm 46 now. So I'm an old dude here talking about old people in AA. Anyways, the irony there is crazy. But I didn't do anything. I just was going to the meeting. It was 3 days a week I was going to that meeting. I was driving around going to other meetings. But going into this YPAW conference, it really, like, this is something I want to continue doing. And I've gone to Pensipaw every year since, except for 1 year. I missed 1 year. My wife's best friend had gotten married, and I just couldn't get her to let me get out of that. She was so unreasonable, honey. She'll probably listen to this, so I just want her to, you know, I just want her to know that. So I talked to her about, like, maybe we could just drive up after, like, right after the thing, we could just go. And she's like, no, I need to be here for her. And I was like, oh, there's that selflessness. But it was a great service. They're doing well, so it was worth it. And so I got involved with that okay, good, I still have some time. What time do I need to stop? 10 o'clock? Do I keep talking till 10? Nobody said no, so I'll take that as a yes. So I got involved in... I went back to my home group, and I talked about how amazing this was, and they were like, yeah, that's great, whatever, you go do that thing. And the following year, I went again, and I took some people with me. And they were like, this is amazing, I want to go forever. And only one of those people kept going. And so we came back after Pensipaw in Allentown, and we were like, we need to do this in our city. And so we put a committee together, and we put a bid in, and we got it in. We hosted Pensipaw, and that was an amazing experience. And then I had the opportunity to be a part of the advisory committee for Pensipaw, which was, I got to tell you, I refer to it as my traveling home group. Every year I go to this event, and I see people that I've known for years who show up every year. It's beautiful because I have... I've made so many friends through being involved in service that I frequently will travel and just stop at their house to hang out. And it's such a great experience being involved in service. If it's one of the legacies, my first sponsor really impressed upon me that the things I need to do to be whole in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be involved in service, to have a home group, to work the 12 steps, and to take people through the 12 steps. And so that is what I've been doing since I walked into AA. And now there's the beautiful thing about having time in AA is that there's going to be times, my experience has been, that I've stepped back from it and then have been able to get back into it. There's things that occur in life. So I've gone to school. I've got two associate's degree, most of a bachelor's degree. That's a whole nother story right there in and of itself. The learning disability has definitely played into difficulties in my education. But one of the things that I have not stopped entirely is to quit. I might stop for a period of time, but eventually I go back and I keep working on it. And that's something that I learned here, really, is just to keep doing what I need to do. Even when I fall back, that does not mean it's the end. It just means that I've fallen back some. So some of the other things, my wife and I got married in 2003. We moved in together first in 2001, and it's why this is important is because we moved in together. We were living together for 2 years, and my grandmother became desperately ill, and she needed constant care. And so my wife and I talked about it, and my aunt was having a really hard time doing it. And my wife and I talked about it, and we moved into my grandmother's house. And her and I still worked, but my wife was the primary caregiver for my grandmother. And I'll never forget the selflessness that my wife practiced. And it was really hard for both of us to be there because my grandmother, God love her, is not the easiest to get along with. Why this is important is because when I was sitting in the hospital when they were going to do exploratory surgery, and the doctor was like, there's like a 50% chance. Like she might not live through this. We don't even know what we're going to find. But we have to go in because they had done every single test and scope and everything. And so as I'm sitting in the waiting room, my family, they went and drank because that's what alcoholics do when adversity comes along. And I'm sitting in the waiting room by myself and I called my first sponsor, Alan. And I was like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, what's wrong? And I was like, nah, I'm in the hospital waiting. He's like, hold on, I'm going to be there. And he lived in like an hour away, and he was there in about 40 minutes. They were just sitting down to eat dinner. And so he came and sat with me when I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Nobody else did. And so my grandmother did live past that. She just recently passed away at almost 98 years old. And so I was able to be there the day that she died because I'm told to suit up and show up. Not even when I don't want to, when it's scary and I don't want to go and it's whatever. I go because I'm supposed to. And then what happens when I do the things I'm supposed to, I reap these amazing rewards because I get so much more than what I ever expected to get out of it. And that reminds me of, and I'm going to close it up soon, I promise. I remember sitting at the clubhouse on 19th Street in Harrisburg, and I'd spend a lot of time there because early on I didn't have anything else going on. And there was this one crazy guy, he got sober when he was 19, and he was in his 40s at the time. And I say crazy because he just had concepts that I didn't understand. And he was in the middle of a conversation, and he turns to me abruptly, and he says, "The alcoholic mind can't comprehend sobriety." And he just looked at me for a minute. "The alcoholic mind can't comprehend sobriety." And then he turned and went right back into his conversation with the other guy. And I'm like, what the just happened? Like, I don't even understand what he's talking about. And like, I'm just sitting there in awe because he's crazy, you know what I mean? But like, it's like, boom. I didn't even, so he turned around and he explained to me, like 10 minutes later, I was sitting there with my, like, close your mouth and not listen to what I have to say. And it talks about that in our literature, that I don't know what sobriety is like. I don't know until I have it. And then I only know then in retrospect, when I look back. So my experience with working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is having these spiritual experiences throughout the whole process that I didn't even realize I was having. And I'm so glad that I didn't know, because I would have probably poked my chest out and got all ego-filled and thought it had something to do with me. But I had all these little clear recognitions that really, looking back, didn't make any sense at the time. I remember when I was about 6 months sober, sitting in a clubhouse, and I shared, like, because I just had this amazing epiphany, like this amazing thing just occurred. And I was like, oh, I get it. I know what you guys are talking about. I get it. If you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk. I understand what you're saying now. It took me 6 months to figure that out. Like, really. Like, as I sat down with my sponsor, my present sponsor, and we went through the book line by line, I remember saying to him, Carl, I don't know that I've gotten more spiritual as this process is going on. But one thing I do know is that my tolerance for pain has decreased. Like, I can't do all the same things that I used to do and feel okay. And he went, aha. And so I knew I was doing something right, because I hardly ever got aha from my sponsor. So as I continue this process, like, it says that as I reveal myself to God, God reveals himself to me, or vice versa. As I continue to walk this path, I start to understand a little bit more. And the understanding is that I know very little. I know what I'm supposed to do. And the great part about that is it's laid out in our book. These 12 steps, they're designed to have me have a spiritual awakening. They're designed to make me of maximum usefulness to God and my fellows. And early on, I didn't know what that meant. Because when I started making this list of things that I was going to achieve in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was all about, what am I going to get from my sobriety? And that's not what the literature says. The literature says that I am going to be useful to others. And that is not always easy. And I'm sure a lot of you can relate. Sometimes it's a struggle being there for other people. My experience with that is it always works out the best, even when I don't like it. And I'm not saying that when I say it works out the best, I'm not saying that it works out the best for me. Especially for me. Sometimes it looks and feels really scary or uncomfortable, I should say uncomfortable, for me when things are working out the best. So my wife and I have 9-year-old triplets. Yeah, there's no history in either one of our families, and we did not use fertility drugs. I remember when I found out, I said to my sponsor, Carl, I was like, I don't usually argue with God's plan. I don't. Like, I pray for it. I beg for it. Like, when it's coming, I'm like, yes. but I don't agree with God. Triplets, no. No, there's no, I don't get it. Carl, I'm too selfish for triplets. And he quipped back with, that's why you got triplets, because you're too selfish. You know, sponsors always know what to say. I hate them. I love them. So as I continue to walk this path, I've had the opportunity to sponsor men, which is amazing. I've had some opportunities to sponsor women too, which is, I was waiting for the, so I don't encourage it. When it was presented to me, and I've had several women over the years ask me to sponsor them. The first thing I was told was, if you're physically attracted to them in any type of way whatsoever, you need to say no immediately. And I know when I am and when I'm not. If at any point in time, if that occurs, I need to say, we need to readjust this sponsor-sponsee relationship. Usually what happens when I've sponsored women, right up to the point where they get a boyfriend, and the third step, and that's for men too. So it has to do with when I sponsor folks, when I came in and started working the steps, I felt empty. And it was easy to feel that way until I really knew it, when I was really and that was right around the same time when I was working the third step. And then a book, it talks about it, that emptiness that we feel. And what's supposed to replace that is God. I'm supposed to find a power greater than myself through the practice of these steps. But what happens for me is I want an easier, softer way, even in AA. And so what happens is I do that. So, my 3 months, I found a girlfriend too, or she found me. And so that leads me into the 13th step, air quote. So I was 13 stepped. I was 3 months. She had 2.5 years, and it was a really difficult time in my early sobriety. I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but that's because I had a little extra time. I was not ready to be in a relationship. Not because I had 3 months, but because I hadn't done my fourth and fifth step. And so when people ask me, when guys ask me that I sponsor, and they're like, well, when can I get involved in a relationship? First, once you realize, once you're at the point where you don't want to be in one, is when that'll probably be a good time. But but better off is when you've done a thorough fourth and fifth step. And my experience is once I did a thorough fourth and fifth step, I didn't want to be in a relationship. Right? Like, I was good right up until I did that. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so messed up. And the beautiful piece to that is, so those first three steps are fantastic to get me to the point when I'm ready to start doing some work. And then I start doing that work, and I'll tell you what my experience has been when I get to the ninth step. When I made that amends to my ex-wife, and I sat across from her, and I gave her this list of things that I knew I had done wrong. And I said, what did I miss? Is there anything that I had done or said or the way I acted that I didn't mention? And she mentioned that piece that I said earlier, that she felt, we lived in the same house, but she felt separated from me. Like I wasn't even there, like she wasn't even there. Like she wasn't a person in this relationship. And she would start fights with me out of the sole purpose of having some type of interaction. And I was floored. That was more than I ever thought of. I just thought it was because she was unreasonable and needed to calm down. But here, much like everything else, right? At some point in time, I had stepped on the toes of my fellows and they retaliated, seemingly without provocation. Like I didn't know until I did the ninth step. And so, man, that has helped me in every single relationship moving forward from her. And when I met with her and I was like, you know, can I meet with the kids? I'd like to make an amends to them. And she said, don't ever talk to my kids. And I was like, okay. Because I had screwed things up enough. Their dad left them. I came into their life for 3 years, and I left them again. I left them too. That's something I need to walk with. There's no fixing that. So in relationships now, I consider that. I think about that because that's going to be part of my walking amends, my living amends for the rest of my life. And there's several things like that. 10, 11, and 12 is where I live. 10, 11, and 12, from my experience, is just the culmination of all those first 9 steps pushed in together, and now practice, work, do this work. And so I do a 10-step inventory. I really appreciate the spot check inventory, and what my present spot check inventory is telling me is that it's time for me to close. Thank you for letting me share.